Hey everybody, this is Kim C, and you're listening to The Year of Underrated Stephen King. I am Kim C, your hostess with the mostest. I'm a university fiction teacher by day and a podcaster by night, making my way across the underrated works of the incomparable Stephen King. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome to part three of our Green Mile coverage. Today we're going to be examining Coffee's Hands. This one was released in May of 1996. So this is your chance where if you haven't yet participated with us at the start of our Green Mile journey, jump back to episodes 1 and 2, where we explore part 1, The Two Dead Girls, and part 2, The Mouse on the Mile. And then you'll be ready for today's episode, which is part 3, Coffee's Hands. We would love for you to head back to 1932 with us, hang out on the Green Mile of Cold Mountain Prison in what might be, I'm saying it now, folks, even though we're only halfway there, one of the richest, most powerful King reading experiences out there. Granted, of course, there's a few others we could throw in to that mixing pot if you're interested, but this one, oh my goodness, dear friends, I am enjoying this story quite a bit, and I have a lot of emotion, I have a lot of feels, but thus far, I am utilizing this Signet paperback for my reading copy. We're approximately almost 300 paperback pages in, but they're very little, very skinny little paperback pages. So we're halfway there. But thus far, it is so well written, listeners. It's so strong. The characters are so well done that whilst I was drifting off to sleep last night, I was tinkering with my mental top 5 King novels, as we all do, at least a lot of us constant readers. I was going through my Stephen King ranking, and although I'm not yet done with my Stephen King journey, so there's a little bit of wiggle room there, not only have I decided as of last night, The Green Mile is definitely in my top 10, but I think it could. Depending on how this shakes loose, I think it could sneak into my top 5. And if that happens, folks, you know, wow. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. But there's quite a few people I think are in that same boat who have The Green Mile very, very close to the top. So thus far, it is wooing me. The writing is top notch. It definitely already has its claws on my mind. These are characters and moments that I probably won't forget, and I don't think many readers of this novel will forget them. So just something to nosh on a little bit as we get ready to talk a little bit about part 3. For those of you who are just tuning in, The Green Mile was a very cool, unique writing experience for King. This entire thing is composed in installments. And as we make our way toward the end, we might examine if that's why we have such literary strength in this story, if it is the way it was composed, or if it's just the characters and the execution in general. We're going to take a look at that more towards the end. But this particular installment is 90 pages in the Signet paperback. It was released in May of 1996. 30 days before that, in April of 96, was part 2, and then the first one was March of 96, The Two Dead Girls. So that's kind of where we're at. In this episode, what we're going to do is a recap of what happened in this installment, Coffee's Hands. We're going to kind of see where we're at, what we've learned thus far in the actual plot of the story. And then in the next section, we're going to isolate and take a look at a lovely chunk of text. We're going to examine some prose and some King writing that I found quite lovely, layered, intense, beautiful, powerful, all those things. And then we're going to kind of unpack a little bit in terms of an isolated moment, a character. We're just going to put the microscope onto a subject, a topic that I really want to unpack a little bit more in this installment. So going forward, I am not going to reveal a lot. I'm going to try to be vague. There's some really great details in this story that are just really memorable and a very telling, kind of dramatic, very good. I'll mention the ones I feel absolutely need to be mentioned, but for the most part, I'm going to keep it vague in case you are doing a reread and you want to stay spoiler free. So going forward, you should be okay in terms of not getting everything spoiled for you, but tread very carefully. Tread very carefully. So let's dive in. Let's do it. Let's break down what's happening in this installment as King is building upon this tale of cops and criminals and the final say of old Sparky the electric chair. So here's our summary. We begin at the Georgia Pines retirement community, which, according to this text, sounds like modern day being 1996. We have our elderly narrator, Paul Edgecombe, and he is watching a 1947 film called Kiss of Death. This is a black and white film starring Richard Widmark. And stop everything you're doing right now if it's safe to do so, and Google this guy right now, guys. Google his face. You need to see it. It's incredibly important. I have not seen this film, so Googling it is, I feel, incredibly important, or whichever search engine you support. Take a look at this guy's mug, friends. He's quite frightening. He has a really menacing face. It kind of reminds me of the bad guy at the end of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, just if that rings any bells, but this guy's really frightening. And the reason why I want you to take a concrete look at his face is because it's pretty integral to understanding why elderly Paul gets really frightened. He gets so frightened and freaked out, his entire body is trembling. He is shaking because this actor, Richard Widmark, in this particular film reminds him viscerally of Wild Bill Wharton, and it's a very uncomfortable memory. Thankfully, his friend Elaine is there. He's got a buddy in at Georgia Pines named Elaine, and they seem to be old chums who help each other out, so she kind of talks him down a little bit, and this leads us right back into Paul's memory, right where we left off at the end of part two, where Wild Bill comes to life playing a cruel joke on the block squad as they're getting him into the cell. He starts to strangle the guard Dean Stanton, and Percy, the POS Wetmore, does nothing. He's just frozen in fear, completely good for nothing. And thankfully, Brutal Howell, the guard, knocks him out, gets behind him, gets a leg up on him. But at this sort of scene, the reader is really got it in their sights that this Bill Wharton is no good, folks. Really no good. He should not be trusted ever, nor should he be underestimated. So after that, earlier in part one, we got to jump back just a little bit because we learned that our narrator Paul tells the reader that in 1932 he had one of the worst urinary tract infections of his life. And so that is something mentioned in part one, and it picks up again here in part three. So I felt so bad for Paul, guys. This guy is suffering with a capital S. He is basically, not to Well, I was going to say he did the guy thing, but that's not fair. I won't say that. But there are a select few gentlemen that when there's an ailment or a bodily issue, they just kind of wait for it to go away. And I think that's what Paul did. He did not seek medical attention, and this thing's getting really bad. His UTI sounds like, according to descriptions in the text, there's full on, like, pardon the graphic, but this is the book. Pus. There is pus, guys. That's all I'm gonna say. It's nasty. I think it's spread to his entire bladder. He is feverish. He is sweating. And when he urinates, he nearly collapses from the pain, as well as having to stifle his screams. My friend, this guy he's in bad shape. Like, this thing could take him out if he doesn't go to the hospital soon. But John Coffey summons him over to his cell, and the text says, and this is kind of an interesting moment, Paul felt a little hypnotized by Coffey. He kind of just did this thing, and we're going to look at it in greater detail in the next section, but he opens the cell and he gets in and he sits down next to Coffey on the bunk, and Coffey puts his hands on Paul, specifically the torso, genital area, I suppose, enough for Paul to kind of react and get a little frightened. And upon Coffey's hands touching Paul, a surge of energy goes through his body. It doesn't seem incredibly dramatic, like shaking or, you know, a kind of huge tremor, but he feels something, a very alive. And after John removes his hands, he starts to cough and expels a great big ball of gnats or tiny flying bugs. I believe in the actual text, the word noceums is used. So tiny little fly bugs, the kind that when you're riding your bike flies directly onto your chapstick, and it's pretty gross. And then they quickly disappear. And so Coffey simply tells Paul he helped it, that he just wanted to help. And then Paul is completely 100% miraculously healed of his urinary tract infection. So after this, Paul is incredibly curious. He drives about 50 miles south or north, I'm actually not sure. He wants to find out more about Coffey. And he drives to meet the journalist who, I guess, it's not super specific, covered the Coffey case. And this guy's name is Bert Hammersmith. So they hang out for a while because Paul wants to learn if Coffey had a previous rap sheet, which he didn't, but Hammersmith kind of reiterates that just because he didn't have previous crimes doesn't mean he didn't snap and do this crime, because sometimes the gentlest, most trusted people or animals just snap. So that quells Paul's curiosity for a minute, because when he returns to Cold Mountain Prison, Wild Bill is causing trouble again, being super gross, acting like an absolute wild child, and they throw him in solitary confinement, they put him in a straitjacket, and he's still just like a hot mess. This guy's energy, guys, he just does not stop. So we have a really cool set of tremendously out there scenes with Wild Bill. There's one with a moon pie. It's humorous and icky, but there's an even better scene, one of my favorites because I hate this character, where Wild Bill scares the literal piss out of Percy Wetmore, which he totally deserved. He totally deserves that and more. Toward the end of part three, the latter half mentions how Warden Hal Moores, who we talked about last week, his wife Melinda has been released from the hospital to basically live out her final days in peace. They cannot do anything for her brain tumor, which gives Paul a little bit of a bright idea regarding the miraculous healing he received from John Coffey. But at the very end, the Block Squad is preparing to rehearse for Edouard Delacroix's execution, and it's in these final pages when the entire squad is just being sweet people, and they're trying to comfort Edouard with his concerns of what will happen to our precious mouse on the mile, Mr. Jingles, after his death. And Yeah, in the last paragraphs of part three, the sniveling little psychopath known as Percy Wetmore steps on, or rather stomps on, Mr. Jingles in front of Edward and kills him. And it breaks his heart, it breaks my heart, and even talking about it now leaves me pretty shattered. And that's how I am at the end of part three, and I believe that's how the reader is at the end of part three, as we head into part four, which is called The Bad Death of Edouard Delacroix. So yeah, great, looking forward to it. I totally am not, but I signed up for this. I signed up for this path of pain, and I'm gonna see it through. We're gonna get through it. That's what I'm gonna do. But that's our summary. That's our kind of roundabout hopscotch through part three, because I think it's important we know what goes down so we can kind of unpack it a little bit more. And that's what we're gonna do in this next installment, in this next chunk. So let's head down the road, let's go a little deeper into Trepangas County and look at more from The Green Mile, Part 3, Coffee's Hands. Hi everybody, and thank you for joining me as we continue to open up part three of The Green Mile, Coffee's Hands, a little bit more. Before we dive into what's working and what I want to kind of expand upon, let's take a look as to whether we had any new characters come into the spotlight this installment, and we do. We have two of them. So one of them we had mention of in part one and part two, and that's the warden, Hal Moores' wife, Melinda Moores. So she was mentioned in part one and part two for being very sick. She was hospitalized for months. They couldn't figure out what was wrong with her. She had numbness in her left hand, really not doing well. And then it was discovered in part two, Mouse on the Mile, it was a brain tumor. They can't do anything about it. And she would soon be released from the hospital to live out her days in peace, most likely passing away before Christmas. So really somber news surrounding the warden, Hal Moores. But in part three, we do get a physical scene with Melinda Moores. Paul and his wife, I think her name's Joanna, drive over there to be good neighbors, good citizens, and to have a kind afternoon in her company, and they bring over some potluck stuff, and he sees that Melinda is really not doing well. She's lost a lot of weight. Her voice is old and dry, and it's just very sad. There's no mention of she and the warden having children, so they may be a childless couple at this point, which is even more sad. But this is a cool area for the reader to kind of start ruminating on exactly where the character of Paul is, which Paul just received, which the reader and this dramatic irony they have, only the reader and, yeah, really just us know what happened with Coffee and Paul. We are the only ones who were able to find out that Paul was healed. So I really like that in concerning the character of Melinda Moores, Paul and the reader are on the same page, and we're both thinking about how Paul was miraculously healed by this guy named John Coffey on death row at the Cold Mountain Prison, and maybe, just maybe, he might be able to help Melinda. So I think that's where that string is going a little bit, so we might follow that as we go into the next parts of the novel. But Melinda Moores was new to our story, And then the second character I kind of mentioned a little bit in this week's summary, but that is journalist Bert Hammersmith. So this guy was very well written. His scene I really, really enjoyed. I enjoyed it so much. That's actually where we're going to get our sample from today. But Bert Hammersmith is compelling for a few reasons. One is that when you are in his company, which Paul is for the duration of the afternoon, it sounds like, they're outside in the backyard, it's sunny and bright and warm, and they are drinking freshly made root beers, which makes me super duper want to hunt down the recipe and make my own root beer. That sounds amazing. They're drinking root beers, cookies are baking, there's two young children playing nearby, and Bert Hammersmith is kind of telling him what he knows about coffee, but in a very interesting, peculiar way. So a couple things I want to unpack with the character of Bert Hammersmith. Number one is when I was reading this scene between Paul and Bert, I was definitely reminded of where I was in the world, and that was, I don't know about Deep South, but South. Just listening to Bert reminded me as the reader that there is a geographic collective mindset of this time period. And that is that they see the world a particular way. Even post-Civil War, they see it a particular way. Who is to be valued, who is to be feared and controlled. But what's interesting is the reader kind of wants to quickly write off Bert Hammersmith as just an ignorant racist, but we can't really do that because Bert tells Paul, listen, I'm an enlightened man. And he lists off his academic credentials. He tells him where he's gone to school. So he's like, listen, I know you think that I'm just a racist, but I'm not. Here's why I'm telling you what I'm telling you. Here's why I think John Coffey did these things. And it's not because I'm a racist. So it's interesting. It's really interesting how simultaneously he kind of comes across as just a very black and white Southerner who has their thoughts ingrained and rooted in a very cruel, terrible tradition, but yet he also understands what's going on, and yet he still kind of clings to the beliefs that he clings to. So this is a really fascinating scene with Bert Hammersmith, and it's not super clear as to whether or not he in fact covered the coffee case, or if he's just, I think that's assumed that he did, but it's apparently he's the journalist that Paul seeks out who knows a lot about it. So I liked this scene quite a bit. I liked Bert Hammersmith as a character quite a bit. He was much more layered than I expected. And I like that we're outside of the Green Mile for a little bit. It's a little refreshing to be out in nature and around not a creepy prison with Wild Bill and a bunch of other unsavory characters, guards included. And so we're kind of in this place of life, and this is post Paul's healing, so he's free from the suffering in his body, and now he's in the sunshine kind of talking to this guy about who is this John Coffey, what do you know about him, because what we and Paul know is that he just received a miracle. So this was a very cool scene, and Bert Hammersmith is a character I hope we hear from again because I was intrigued by him. You want to write him off as just a very ignorant person who's very close-minded, but we can't. We can't really do that because he himself has suffered quite a bit, he and his family, which is leading me into the scene I would like to share with everybody today. So this scene really doesn't have anything to do with our main plot, with our main sort of source of action, which is the Green Mile and all of our inmate characters, all of our guards. This has to do with Bert Hammersmith and his family. But the writing was so damn good, and the tone really dipped quite a bit. It was somber, it was dark, it was a little bit sinister and frightening and sad, and I was just all about it. This was the strongest piece. Granted, there are several places that absolutely had me swooning in this installment, But this is the one I kept thinking about after I finished reading, so I'd like to share that with all of you today. So once more, I'm using the Signet paperback, the little skinny paperbacks from Signet, released in the 1996 release schedule. This is at the bottom of page 47. The little girl, surely his twin, they had to be of an age, went on into the kitchen. The little boy came to his father, looking down at his feet. He knew he was ugly. He was only 4, I guess, but 4 is old enough to know that you're ugly. His father put 2 fingers under the boy's chin and tried to raise his face. At first, the boy resisted, but when his father said, "Please, son," in tones of sweetness and calmness and love, he did as he was asked. A huge circular scar ran out of his hair, down his forehead, through one dead and indifferently cocked eye, and to the corner of his mouth, which had been disfigured into the knowing leer of a gambler or perhaps a whoremaster. One cheek was smooth and pretty, the other was bunched up like the stump of a tree. I guess there had been a hole in it, but that, at least, had healed. "He has the one eye," Hammersmith said, caressing the boy's bunched cheek with a lover's kind fingers. "I suppose he's lucky to not be blind. We got down on our knees and thanked God for that much, at least. Eh, Caleb?" "Yes, sir," the boy said shyly. The boy who would be beaten mercilessly on the play yard by laughing, jeering bullies for all his miserable years of education. The boy who would never be asked to play spin the bottle or post office, and would probably never sleep with a woman not bought and paid for once he was grown to manhood's times and needs. The boy who would always stand outside the warm and lighted circle of his peers. The boy who would look at himself in his mirror for the next 50 or 60 or 70 years of his life and think, "Ugly, ugly, ugly." "Go on in and get your cookies," his father said, and kissed his son's sneering mouth. "Yes, sir," Caleb said, and dashed inside. Hammersmith took a handkerchief from his back pocket and wiped at his eyes with it. They were dry, but I suppose he's gotten used to them being wet. Folks, did you hear that? Did you feel that? Holy shiitake mushrooms. That was heavy. That was heavy. And it's just one paragraph. King just brings the pain of this little boy named Caleb, who we find out was harmed by the family dog named Sir Galahad. It seemingly came out of nowhere, which is what Hammersmith uses to explain to Paul Edgecombe that it doesn't matter how gentle, sweet, kind, unassuming you think someone is, in a snap, they can ruin everything. They can absolutely become the monster and destroy your world. And that's what he's telling Paul to embrace in terms of his opinion of John Coffey. John Coffey, according to Bert Hammersmith, is the murderer of the Dederek twins. He is their killer, pure and simple, full stop, period. And it would be wise for our narrator, Paul Edgecombe, to embrace that and just not pursue anything else. But we know as the reader, and Paul knows, that we have to, right? So to recap the introduction of new people, we had the warden's wife, Melinda Moores. I'm very, very curious as to what happens with her in the next couple chapters. And then we have journalist Bert Hammersmith. So what we're going to do right now is kind of observe what I feel is working really well. This is the area of the episode where I kind of isolate things that got me thinking and we unpack them a little bit more. But the only one I really want to talk about with you guys, the only one that I feel is just a bubbling pot, is that of the character John Coffey. So we have so much to talk about in regards to John Coffey, dear friends. Like, when I started to make my notes for John, we have so much to cover. So because we're only in part three, we're not gonna do it all today. So what I have titled in terms of this bullet point is what we know about John Coffey so far. And we're just gonna talk about what the reader knows at this point halfway into the story. And I'm gonna give you a tiny little crumb, a little crumpet of what we are gonna talk about toward the latter half of this story, as well as at the very end, because for those of you who have read The Green Mile, and this is the first time that I'm reading it all the way through, but I have seen the film, so I know I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage there. I do know John Coffey's true nature. However, there is so many things, folks. So many things. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a sneak preview as to what we're really going to talk about at the end of our Green Mile coverage, because John Coffey is somebody who needs a lot of discussion. But what I do want to take a look at is what we know about John Coffey thus far. And this is just sort of the facts. The reader thus far has this about John Coffey, and that is that we get consistent. One of the points I have is he is consistently teary-eyed, dripping tears. So John, I think, is 1,000% an empath, empathic. He feels the pain of everyone and really everything. Ergo, he is consistently crying tears. And we learn from psychology, especially like when you listen to investigative interviews with suspects, if they start to cry but there's no tears, that's a huge sign for investigators. Tears are everything. Tears are really true signs of pain, the actual water coming out of the eyes. So John Coffey is consistently crying. But I don't know if it said he's like doing the wailing cry, like with lots of physical sounds of sobs coming out of his mouth. I just think he's consistently has teary eyes and just wiping tears all the time. So that leads me to believe John is very empathic, constantly picking up on the energy or pain of everything. And we have no idea, at least until this part in the novel, how far that goes, like what exactly he is feeling. So number two, or the second bullet point I have in regards to what we know about John Coffey, is healing power. So we just saw this. This is sort of like the main event of part three, Coffey's Hands, is the healing power of John Coffey. He put his physical hands, so that's huge, the physical touch of John Coffey on Paul's body, allowed for the removal of this infection and the infusion of life and wholeness and healing. And that seemingly was in a split second, and then John Coffey was able to expel it, perhaps in the form of bugs. That's reaching a little bit. We don't know via text if that's what happens, so we want to be very careful with like assuming. We have to stick to the text on this one. So what we know is that that potentially might be how it works, but I'm unsure, so just throwing that out there. So healing power, and we've thus far only seen it with Paul, although I'm really hoping I see it with Jingles next week, because I cannot, guys. So we see Coffey has physical healing power. We don't know what it is, but our friend Paul was miraculously, instantaneously healed. The other thing we got mention of, and this was at the very end of part three, is seemingly John Coffey is a mind reader. So this is very subtle. This was in the last few pages of part three when the squad is talking to Edouard about what's going to happen to Mr. Jingles, and they're trying to make him feel better, and they're placating him a little bit, and they're making up a nice little scenario to comfort him. And there's a part where Paul's about to say something to Edouard about Mr. Jingles, but he looks over at John Coffey, and John Coffey shakes his head and says no. And so Paul sort of tells the reader that, like, he knew what I was going to say, and he disagreed with it, and he told me not to. So seemingly, we have a little bit of indication from the text that John Coffey can read minds. So this is huge. This is very powerful. This is very important, which allows us as the reader to gain more evidence that John is incredibly special. We have been getting tiny bite-sized little flickerings of that heading into part three, but by part three, where we're at now, it's kind of being established that he is very special. The fourth thing that we learned in part three is that, bless him, this breaks my heart so much to even talk about, John has been physically beaten and whipped throughout his entire life, and I believe Bert Hammersmith tells Paul that the scars on his back are latticed and kind of all over the place, indicating that he was beaten at a young age. He was whipped at a young age as he was growing, and so that's what the scars are indicative of, which absolutely shatters me to my soul. So he's got terrible, terrible whip/scars all over his back, which is awful, and the fact that he was young and suffering that is awful. So we learn that John Coffey has had perhaps a lot of physical abuse his entire life. We also know that he's a little bit on the simple side, but I hesitate to even say that because what we know about John is he's incredibly quiet, right? He's very quiet, and when he does speak, it's slow and simple, and slow as in pacing. He's just a slow speaker. He's not necessarily incoherent, nor is he's perfectly understood. So I hesitate. The text says that he's somewhat mentally on the slower side. We don't have evidence of that thus far. We know that his English is a little bit simple. It's a little sort of early English speaker, you know, someone who didn't have a formal education, but I don't think there's any indication that he's not an intelligent person in terms of what we know thus far. In terms of speaking and maybe communicating, he's a little bit slower in how he gets his thoughts across, but we don't have too much evidence that he's hasn't any sort of intellectual handicap, at least from what I've observed in the text. I haven't, unless I missed something. If I did, you guys can definitely flag it and send it my way. That's what we have thus far. We also, of course, John's hulking size. He is 6'8". He is over 300 pounds. He is, unfortunately, bless him, unable to fit normal size clothes, or average size clothes, I should say. So he's unable to fit in average male sizes. So everything's a little bit just kind of tight on him, and he's too tall, so everything's a little high water on him. But he is a lot of person, but has, from what we can see, he has a very gentle, warm, unassuming, kind, quiet, way about him. So we're going to recap what we know about John Coffey thus far. Of course, he is constantly dripping tears, leading me to believe he's consistently feeling pain of some kind. We don't know if that's a physical ailment or if he is an empath and just feeling the pain of the world. That's my guess. Healing power. He is able to, in this case, heal the sick. More on that in a second. But he physically touched Paul and healed him of his disease. We have him potentially having the ability to mind read. I hope we see more of this in the next coming installments. So, potential mind reader. He is someone who has been abused physically throughout his formative years based on the scars on his back. And then he is a very large individual who doesn't seem to use his body as a way to intimidate people of any kind. He knows his voice is deep. He is somebody who is sort of quiet. He's a thinker, but he lets the pain flow freely with the tears running down his eyes. So that's what we've observed thus far in parts 1, 2, and 3. So this is the part where I give you a little VIP sneak peek into what we're really going to uncover with John Coffey. And that is two concepts that if you guys are constant listeners and you've observed other Stephen King podcasts, the other hosts do a tremendous job of kind of discussing this character trope we see in a lot of King's work, but it's important to kind of mention it here, but I'd like to debate it a little bit, and that is the concept of the magical Negro character versus the messianic character. So we're gonna unpack that, nobody freak out, but the magical Negro throughout King's work and throughout literature in general, we have black characters with supernatural abilities. Specifically in King, think of Dick Halloran from The Shining. He is descended from a long line of black family members who had this gift of telepathy. We also have Mother Abigail from The Stand, and I think she's really unique because she's a little bit of both in terms of her supernatural abilities, but she's also messianic. So messianic is what we're gonna really, really unpack with John Coffey. We're gonna do this much greater toward the end of our coverage, but messianic comes from the word Messiah. Messiah is a Hebrew word meaning the one who was sent. So this is in specific reference to if you're looking at it through a Judeo-Christian lens or through a Christian lens, that is Jesus Christ of Nazareth. He is the Messiah, the one who was sent, said to be the Son of God. But if it's through a strictly Jewish framework, Messiah has not yet arrived. The foretold Messiah who would defeat all of Jerusalem's enemies and unite the kingdoms of Israel, he's not here yet. He hasn't arrived, but he would be descended from David's line. He would be like King David, so we could nerd out on that another time. But the messianic character is in reference here, the way King is using it is in a Christ-like way. And if you look at the initials, John Coffey, JC, that was intentional, folks. That was absolutely intentional to be a messianic figure, a messianic character. So John Coffey is slightly... and we're going to examine this more, but right now we can infer from the text that he is a representative, a sort of avatar for Jesus Christ. So we're going to take a lot more deeper look at that as we go, but I want you to keep that in mind as we make our way through the Green Mile. And we'll also have some biblical allusion here. Remember how I talked about how powerful the touch is? I mean, guys, this part 3, is literally called Coffey's Hands, right? We have to look at that. It's huge. So Coffey's Hands, when you look throughout the New Testament, when Jesus was performing his miracles, he laid hands on people. He physically touched them. He also spit in their face. That one's a great one. I'll tell you about that parable here coming up. It's not a parable, but it super happened. Jesus spat in a guy's face and it was miraculous. He was a blind man and he could see after that. It was pretty crazy. Crazy in a good way. But he touched people. So the fact that John Coffey physically touched Paul is very big. He didn't whisper, specific magical incantation words. He didn't have a wand, you know, he didn't wave his hands and summon the energy or propel the force Star Wars style. No. He physically touched him. And that's very huge because I think that's what King is doing with John Coffey, is having him appear Christ-like and messianic. So that's a tiny little breadcrumb. That's all we're going to talk about. As you can see, I'm having a hard time shutting up about it now because I'm excited. But my guys, John Coffey is powerful in terms of, A, we know he's powerful in the story. My God, he's healing people. And B, I think, I always knew he was a huge King character. I always heard this guy was just a juggernaut on the page. But I was not prepared. As the Gen Z says, consider me shook, everybody. Like, I was not prepared for his power on the page. Like, he is incredibly special. So we are going to unpack more of John Coffey as we make our way through the next three parts. But that's all I have for today. So I know it's a little on the light side, but this installment, we didn't have actually too much of Coffey featured. We have the miracle between he and Paul, but for the most part, it was mostly about Wild Bill being crazy and Percy being awful. And of course, we are preparing to lose Edouard Delacroix. We're preparing to have him die by the hands of Old Sparky. That was the majority of what was in focus in this part, but Coffey is still a great mystery to us. However, I think it's important that halfway through we talk about what we know thus far. We talk about the power that King is giving him on the page, the mystery, as well as the pain that he's giving all of us by what's happening in the Green Mile. He's really unlocking a lot of drama. This character writing is 10 out of 10, dear friends. Like, I'm just obsessed. It's so dang good, the story. I'm loving it thus far. And I just have hope that Mr. Jingles will be okay. That's all I can say. Okay. I think that's time. It's time to go. It's time for Kipsy to go. But thank you guys for listening to my coverage of The Green Mile Part 3, Coffey's Hands. I hope you're enjoying it thus far. Let's do a check-in. Go ahead and write into the show at underratedsk@gmail.com. Send me a line. Send me a message. You can reach me at underratedskpod on Twitter and Instagram. I would love to hear from you. Let me know if this is your first time reading through the story, like it is mine, or if you're revisiting it, or if you just watched the movie recently, or what are your thoughts about some of these characters? I would love to know what you think. So let's do a halfway check-in. Let's do a conjugal visit, if you will. A conjugal visit, as listeners. Let's check in. If you would be so kind to give the show a 5-star on Apple Podcasts, we would love you forever. That would be tremendous. We appreciate you so much. And if you could give us a review saying something kind, following Thumper's rule from Bambi, we would also love you for that. But thank you guys so much. We're going to take off. And we're going to start diving into part 4, The Bad Death of Edouard Delacroix. It is with a heavy heart that I open and crack open the page to that one. But before we go, let's take a look at our final question for the sweepstakes. According to my Signet paperback, this is so much fun, guys. If we answer the following question and write into the Green Mile Part 3 contest in Medford, New York, if we could time travel back to 1996, I wonder if we could win. So the question is, King constantly portrays Percy much less sympathetically than Delacroix or Coffey. What is he trying to say? Write your answer on a separate piece of paper in 50 words or less. Interesting. I would need to mull over. We all know the answer. We know why he's doing it. But how do we succinctly say that in 50 words or less? So, by the way, if anybody wrote into this contest and won, you need to let me know. I gotta know about this, guys. I must know. So, I hope you're having a good time. I am, even though the subject is heavy and bleak and sad, it's still good because it's still King, right? And he's still the best in the West. All right, friends. Take care, everybody. I hope everyone is doing well. I'll see you next week for part 4 of The Green Mile. Bye-bye.